You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, I talk with David Tamarkin, editor of Epicurious, about Cook 90, his quest to cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day for the entire month of January. We check in with him, see how that's going. And then I sit down with Bon Appetit food director, Carla Lally Music, who walks me through the how-to of slow roasting. Not braising, not traditional roasting, but slow roasting, which is like magic. It's going to blow your mind, or at least it kind of blew my mind. All right, let's do this. Here's me and David Tamarkin. Tamarkin, Cook 90, you're back at it. How's it going?
It's going well. I'm in the middle of it now.
Yeah, what you're at what, like Cook 23 right now?
Yeah, let's see. It's the 12th day or 13th, whatever. Yeah, it's about 30 meals, and I haven't skipped any so yet, which is good. I get three passes. I haven't used any yet, so that's good.
Well, yeah, because that's before we get into like how's it going this year, and I want to know what you learned from your experience doing Cook 90 last year. For the listeners, let's refresh, and for me also, what are the parameters you set for yourself? What are the guidelines for cooking 90 meals in 1 month?
It's very simple, and by design, I don't want it to have very many rules. So it's just you cook three meals, breakfast, lunch, dinner, every day, the whole month of January. So you're cooking 90 meals total, but you get three meals off. That's why it's Cook 90 and not 93. The only other rule really is that you can't use the leftovers too many times. So I cooked a Thai curry last night. I can eat it for lunch today. I could even eat it for lunch again tomorrow, but that's it. You can only use your leftovers so many times before.
So is it twice or is it too many times? What is too many times?
it's twice. You can eat your leftovers twice.
What about, which I know we've talked a lot about at Bon Appetit with sort of upping your desk lunch game and whatnot. Can you make like a batch of grains on Sunday and then use those throughout the week?
Absolutely. In fact, that's the only way you can really stay sane, and it's by doing that kind of thing. And we call that nextovers.
Nextovers. Ooh,
so instead of leftovers. So if you cook, whenever you're cooking anything, say you're making chicken thighs for your dinner that night, well, you might as well put eight in the oven instead of four. You have four that night, and then the other four you'd like turn into tacos the next day. That's not leftover chicken thighs because you're thinking about it beforehand. You're making nextovers.
Is that like paying it forward? What does that phrase mean? I've never understood the phrase pay it forward. What does that mean? I always get annoyed by that phrase. I think I know what it means.
It's the opposite of pay it back. It's like don't wait for someone to do something nice for you. Uh-huh. Do it first and then pay it forward.
All right, so you set these parameters yourself.
Yeah.
How does then what you're doing at home manifest itself on epicurious.com?
Well, in so many ways. I mean, Cook 90 really takes place mainly on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And if you just click on the hashtag or follow Epi, the hashtag is Cook 90. There's also another hashtag that sort of bubbled up this year called Team 90, where it's people feel like they're on a team, which I think is really helping motivate people to keep going and to keep cooking.
All right. So you can go to the Epicurious Instagram
page or mine, David Tamarkin, or just search for Cook 90.
But have you found that there are teammates on Team 90 that you don't know? That I know you have people at work who are into it.
Tons. Really? No, there are 35,000 people signed up for the Cook 90 newsletter. So 35,000 people this year signed up to take the challenge. And some of them are posting every day. Some of them are just emailing me. They're not posting on Instagram. A lot of these people don't have Instagram. So they're emailing me their photos, just me personally, and saying, hey, David, this is what I cooked today. And I write back, that's great. And it is great. I mean, and you would not believe some of the things I'm hearing from people.
Can we do the sort of thing where like one of those sort of ABC sort of, you know, TV specials where you show up at their door somewhere?
I would love that.
In your home state of Ohio.
Send me to Ohio, send me to Omaha, knock on the door and say, let's cook together, let's cook a casserole.
What do you think is resonating with these teammates of yours?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think the fact that there are not dietary restrictions is really important here. Mm-hmm. I think that...
So it's about cooking. It's about cooking real food for yourself. Right. Whatever that means to you,
exactly.
That's cool. But get in the kitchen, cook for yourself.
If you want to eat
family, friends,
mac and cheese every day, that's sort of against the Cook 90 rules because you are encouraged to not cook the same thing every day. But you could cook a different mac and cheese every day, and that's fine. And that's, you know, do you. I think that we are in a space where people are being told a lot what to cook and how to cook, and that certain cooking is bad and this cooking is better, and you should be eating, you know, your chia seeds every day and not eating, you know, white bread. And I think it's very refreshing for people to be like, look, cooking is hard enough, so I can just cook whatever I want, and that's a good thing, because I cooked it. I didn't get it from takeout. I didn't go to a restaurant. I didn't, you know.
What about, do you consider, I mean, yeah, there's the phrase cooking and what that means to various people. Like, if you bring to lunch one day some cured salami, a hunk of cheese, and some crackers, is that enough? Does that constitute as one of your 90s?
Yeah, I think that particular example is walking the line. So what I say is, if you have taken an ingredient and transformed it somehow. So if you've taken a raw potato and you have baked that potato, you've transformed it, you've cooked something. Or if you've taken two or more ingredients and combined them to create something new.
Like peanut butter and jelly.
Yes, and you've cooked something. Or like a salad. Like, I mean, you don't have to heat anything to make a salad, but you're creating something new out of these ingredients. So that particular example, I think, is cooking. It's sort of walking the line. Like, but, you know, earlier this week, one of my most popular Cook 90 posts this week has been a lunch I made where I brought a jar of tuna. Like, I chose like oil packed some nicer tuna.
Fancy
and
boy.
A can.
Fancy boy alert.
A can of white beans, and I mixed in like a little like a kind of pesto sauce and ate it with crackers. That was one of the most powerful posts I had last week, because people were really, I think they saw that and they were like, oh, that's so easy and that counts.
But let me ask you this, David Tomarkin.
Yeah.
What if you had gone to, say, Citarella, like my wife does sometimes, and buys their homemade refrigerated pesto and stirred that in? Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you make the pesto or did you buy it?
I made, so this is not quite a pesto. It's a roasted garlic herb sauce, which is my recipe. It's on Epicurus, and it's something that I think is really handy to have on hand, because you can stir it into eggs. You can
What's in it?
Well, you take a whole head of garlic and you pan roast it. Do you know about this method? This is something I learned from Rick Bayless when I worked with him. In a cast iron skillet, you put the cloves in with the
peel.
With the peels, it's still on.
Yep.
And you kind of get it all done in 15 minutes. You kind of shake it occasionally to get all sides. And it gets all blackened, but then you peel it. It's soft and roasted. So you do that, and then you put it in a blender with parsley and some mint and chili flakes, lemon juice, and olive oil. And it's a pesto-ish herby sauce.
Get some viscosity.
But you can do anything with that. You could turn that into a salad dressing, or you could put it on a steak or whatever.
Pasta.
So, but, pasta, right, just toss it. But pesto, store-bought pesto, fine, do that. Or I think that having a pesto, like a hot sauce, like a harissa or something like that, mayonnaise, just having an arsenal of sauces in your fridge is one of the best ways to prepare to do something like Cook 90, or just basically to cook. Because I lean on that stuff all the time.
When do you do your big shop for the week? And do you try to do one shop a week, or what's your policy?
Yeah, I think it's so much easier if you do one shop a week. And I think, so those are two things, the most crucial things for success. One, writing a meal plan for the week, and two, doing a big shop based on that meal plan so that you're prepared.
All right. Let me ask you about that, because the meal plan, like, so much of pulling off a project like this is logistics and planning. You live with your boyfriend, correct?
No, I live without him.
Oh, wow. I don't mean to cause trouble.
No. He's in Washington Heights. I'm in Brooklyn.
So how often, does he participate? You know what I mean? Like, say you live with someone else. Is it easier if that person is doing it with you? So then you're doing lunch for two and you're multiplying? Because it's weird if you're doing dinner for two, but lunch for one and then breakfast, you know?
I know. I mean, let me tell you
what happened
like last night. So Cook 90 for me, it started when my boyfriend was in India. So it was just me. I didn't have to worry about going to his house or cooking. I was just cooking for myself and in Brooklyn. And that was easier than what's happened, say, last night, where I'm at his house, I'm cooking a curry, but I'm also doing next overs, so I'm putting up squash in the oven.
Did you say your boyfriend lives in Washington Heights?
Yes.
For those of you who do not live in New York City, Washington Heights and Brooklyn cannot be farther apart. Washington Heights is the very tip of Manhattan. Brooklyn is all the way south and east.
Yeah, we live a good hour and 20 minutes apart. Yeah.
Do you talk about this in couples therapy?
Not yet. We can get him on the phone if you want to.
I don't know. Isn't half the reason you're in a relationship for just convenience sake? Like, oh, come over, go watch a movie or whatever on the sofa. Yeah. Like, I'll see you like in 2 hours.
Yeah. We definitely have to plan.
So you were doing next overs at his house for the week ahead.
So this morning, left his house, packed up my lunch. So I woke up, boiled eggs for myself for breakfast, packed up the leftover curry from last night for my lunch, and wrapped up an entire roasted butternut squash that I'm taking home with me because to make soup tonight. So I'm on the train with a very heavy bag of food. Like, I have eggs, curry, a whole squash.
What time is this?
7 a.m. Yeah. On the train.
So a little before rush hour, at least, so it's not that packed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's my life. I'm cooking in two places. And because I have to plan ahead, if I didn't bring my lunch or if I didn't roast that squash last night, I would be screwed.
Listen, I imagine Cook 90 is very satisfying and rewarding, but there must be moments like that when you're on the train with all these reps and you're like, this is ridiculous. This is a pain in the ass. Come on.
Absolutely. And that's why you have the passes, but also that's why you have Team 90 for support.
Well, have you thought about just getting a part-time boyfriend for the month of 90? Like a Brooklyn guy.
So now we really are getting into wading into some waters, and we should get him on the phone and we should discuss that. I mean, boyfriends, husbands, wives, they complicate everything. I mean,
it's true.
Life is so much easier if it's just you, okay? Trust me, just a single, especially when you're cooking. And actually, that's something I've gotten a lot of feedback about. A lot of people doing Cook 90 are single people who are cooking for themselves or kind of empty nest households where it's just two people.
Yep, yep.
And they're having trouble finding recipes for two. So we're going to start doing some more of that at Epicurious because, you know, it is sort of frustrating for people who don't have households of four to always see these recipes for four and either, you know,
absolutely
cut them in half or have a lot of leftovers in your fridge and stuff like that. So
So in terms of planning, you know, obviously it's about the shopping. It's about are you doing it together with someone? Couple of thoughts. Do you plan out dinner parties? Is dinner parties part of this so you can make a bunch of food? Or
it's a huge part of it. I mean, because if you – what I found last year was that this can be very isolating, especially if you're like me and you're someone who lives by himself. So, you know, my boyfriend was around last year and we cooked together a lot. But the fact is you're still staying home a lot of the time to cook. And so – there have been a couple of times last week where I made dinner and then I went out and got a drink. But I'm old. Like, I can't stay up that late. Like,
no, I can't. You know? That's the thing. That's the next question about going out. Like, if you live in New York City and I imagine some other big cities and stuff, like, what you do is you go out. People's social lives gravitate around restaurants and bars. Like, that's where you meet people. That's where you meet friends. That's where you hook up, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I got to imagine it's a little tough saying, oh, no, I can't go out next week because I have to be at home by myself cooking.
No, I mean, that's not the answer I give. The answer I give is I can meet you at 9 o'clock or I can meet you.
I don't want to meet you at 9 o'clock. I'm having dinner at 7:30.
I can't.
And by 9:15, I'm going home to go to sleep.
Oh, you're really old. Okay. No, yes. I'm not quite that old yet. I'm like, I can meet you at 9 o'clock for a drink and stay out till like, 11 or 12 and then go home.
Well, I don't know. I'm like, if I'm full and I've had my drinks and my food, like then I'm like, I'm done. I don't need to meet Tamarkin out post. I'm not going to like have an Amaro with you at some.
I like this image. You and I drinking Amaro at what do you, it's be like 8 o'clock so you can go to bed by 8:30?
I have to be home by 10.
Wow.
I prefer to be home by like 9:40 so I could be in bed by 10.
Are you working out in the morning or something? Or
I worked out this morning, yeah.
Okay.
I worked out a couple. No, I just like, I got a kid. Like a kid, Marlon's getting up. He's waking up at 6:20. My alarm's going off at 6:45.
See, again.
I need my 8 hours.
Children, wives, boyfriends, they just ruin everything.
I know.
You know, think about what you could do. We could be out drinking tomorrow at 1 a.m.
Oh, man.
You could just roll into work.
You make it sound so good. I can't argue with you. I'm like trying to find an argument here. I'm like, all right, logistics. All right, so you're going out to meet people for DJ Steve's at 9:15 p.m. You're cooking by yourself at home.
On Sunday night, I just went over to someone's house and I helped them cook the meal. We cooked together. That still counts.
Because it's still homemade. You're just not having next overs the next day.
Well, yeah, you're right. Or I could take. I mean, these are like my best friends, so I feel free just taking those scallops with me. But It's important. Like, most things count. And that's what I think is really important about Cook 90. It's a very important tenet of Cook 90, that it's meant to be easy. It's not meant to be a bunch of rules that you have to follow.
I don't know if I would say easy, but I would say rewarding or satisfying, that it should fulfilling.
It shouldn't be something that constricts you.
Yes.
You know?
What about, so in terms of next overs and planning ahead and all that sort of stuff, what do you do about storagey, sort of transportating sort of units to bring your lunch and stuff?
Like, I have this tiny New York City fridge, and it's so packed with stuff. And I'm using a lot of jars, unfortunately. And I say unfortunately because I feel so twee and Pinteresty about it. But I have a bunch of empty.
You're a pretty twee guy.
Salsa. Oh, thank you.
What kind of jars? You mean like ball jars or weck jars or like? What?
No, they're jars. They're like empty peanut butter jars or empty salsa jars.
So they have screw-on lids.
Yeah, I keep all those.
I would not say that.
Because as we know from last week's podcast, I'm a very environmentally conscious dude. And so I don't throw things away if I don't have to.
Nor should you. But I would not say like salsa jars very Pinteresty. I'd say that's kind of janky.
Oh, thank you. Okay, you're batting 100 here or batting 1,000.
That was 1,000, yeah. But all right, two things though. But like one thing about, my wife's like, no, we shouldn't use plastic. It's bad for you, bad for the kids. Give them cancer.
Oh, I don't believe that.
But one thing about plastic is it's easier to transport and it's lighter.
Yeah.
You don't just use like the leftover Chinese takeout containers and quart containers and those sort of things?
I have them, but that's a lot of food for me. I feel like...
The pint containers, not the quart containers, you know, smaller ones.
Yeah, sure. I'm open to that. I just think that the jars are just a little more compact and they're good. It's a good amount of food for me for lunch.
But is there any brand of explicit storage containers that you like?
No.
We don't have an endorsement deal for Cook 90?
Like what?
I don't know, like a Tupperware sort of thing, like Cook 90 brought to you by Tupperware. Have you thought about that?
I'm sure someone in this building has thought
about
that.
You might want to talk to
Eric. I'm sure they've been approached by somebody.
Eric Gillen, executive director of Epicurious, whatever Eric's title is. We can make that happen. I do like a good storage container. That's what I'm getting at. Because there are a lot of cool ones now. Like all hipstery and stylish.
There's
suction cup tops and everything.
There's a very cool lunch container. Yeah. I forget what it's called, but it has these click-on cooling pads to keep it cold, and it's a very sleek gray thing, and it comes with a little silverware, and you just open up it, and you can. I'll tweet it or something.
And speaking of India, it's always that kind of riff of Tiffins and stuff, those stackable boxes, and I like
those
that.
Are cool.
Have any of your teammates appeal to you and ask you, hey, is this okay? Is this not okay? Have you had to be like, I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah, the one thing that, so a lot of my co-editors at Epicurious are doing Cook 90, which is great, solidarity. And the only time I was like, I don't know about this, is that Tommy Werner, great guy, writer for Epicurious.
I think you have to preface it with great guy.
Great guy, but he did some cooking for his lunch in the Epicurious test kitchen. And I don't know, to me, that's not real.
See, I was thinking about that myself. I'm probably on an average month, a cook 46 guy maybe, or cook 39.
That's
but
pretty good.
No, but see, it's not really, because a lot, 20 of those meals are breakfast in the BA test kitchen. Mm-hmm. I come to work in the morning and I make myself eggs or avocado toast or peanut butter toast. Mm-hmm. Then I would say, 15 of those are lunch in the BA desk kitchen, where I just kind of scavenge to see what they've got and I cobble together something. And then I make dinner a couple of nights each week. So, yeah, because to your point, so much of this is in the shopping, the planning, the sort of metricsing it out, what's interesting about this is that we're speaking about this as a project. My mom, for instance, growing up in Wisconsin back in the 40s and stuff, that's just living. You would make three meals. You would maybe now and then, even when I was a kid, going out to dinner was an unusual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was breakfast, lunch, dinner, homemade.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how we as a country have sort of gotten away from that. And I'm not saying it's a good thing or bad thing, just based on there are a lot of fast casual concepts out there of restaurants that are really good and you can get good food now. And, it's easier and better and oftentimes more affordable than what you might make at home.
And what I think is really interesting about that is it's not about eating out so much anymore. This is not about versus home cooking versus eating out. I don't think people are doing one or the other. What I think has happened is that a lot of people are eating at home, but they're not cooking at home. And there's a real difference between eating at home and cooking at home. You know, whether it's you're ordering food in or you're putting a, you know, Amy's microwavable Indian, you know, saag paneer in the microwave or the oven, or you're getting a meal kit, which is involves cooking. I mean, there are all these different ways that people can not cook.
Yeah.
And I'm, and fine, do you. And I understand, believe me, you know, doing Cook 90, there are times when I really just do not want to cook. So I understand and don't judge anybody for using any of those things. But I do think it's an important skill to have. And I do think it's important. It has all these different benefits, or all these economic and health benefits to cooking at home that we lose out on when we order in, or when we, you know, put that meal in the microwave, that I think doing Cook 90 helps remind you of and sort of sharpens your skills and just keeps it out there as an option. Because I do think we are in danger of becoming a culture that loses this skill. And I know that sounds dramatic, but I do think we are moving that way.
Well, David Tamarkin, thank you very much. Cook 90, you can follow you on what's your...
Instagram, which is just at David Tamarkin.
How do you spell your last name?
T-A-M-A-R-K-I-N.
Okay.
And then you can follow Epicurious. And if you want to do that, but just, you know, follow the hashtag Cook 90. It's interesting to see what other people are doing.
All right. Thanks very much, David.
Thank you.
All right, that was David Tamarkin from Epicurious. And now here is Bon Appetit's Carla Lolly Music. Carla, Life in the Slow Lane Music. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
I'm very excited about this podcast, about slow roasting, although I'm a little skeptical also.
Well, coming off of this like blizzard weekend that we just had, it was, you know, it was all about sticking something in the oven and acting like you're doing something because it's there cooking.
Yeah, and I like the notion of that. I'm kind of scarred from a quote-unquote slow roasting experience years ago.
And was there a dryness in the result or something?
There was a toughness, a dryness. Like this was like, I don't know, like 15 years ago, I had a bunch of like guy friends, none of whom who cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like the guy who would show up with my knives and tools and like, I'm going to cook you guys dinner. And like, you're going to watch football and it's going to be awesome. And I'm making slow roasted barbecued pork shoulder.
Mm.
And I stuck this big hunk of pork in there and you had like 15 like stockbroker bros ready for the food. And like 3 hours later, it's like not at all fall apart tender.
Yeah, it's more like a 5 or 6 hour thing, depending on how big, but with the bone in.
I don't know. I just, like I said, I've sort of erased it from my memory, but it did not. And I think we literally ended up ordering Chinese food or something.
Does braising feel more forgiving to you, a little safer?
Yes, that's what I'm getting. So when you're braising something, as we know, you put something in a pot with a liquid of stock, wine, this and that. You put the top on, you create this like steam bath, and it just luxuriates in there.
Right.
What we're talking about is different. What are we talking about?
What we're talking about is a very similar method, although it seems different, right? So with slow roasting, you have hot air circulation, right?
Yeah.
So that's what the difference between roasting and braising being this, you know, humid, moist environment.
And covered.
And covered. Yeah. But you can cover for a slow roast, which we should talk about.
Mm.
The key thing that kind of links these two things is that similar cuts will behave similarly, right?
Yeah, so let's go through some of those. So let's starting off with the cuts.
The cuts,
most important.
You want a fatty cut. It doesn't necessarily have to be a tough cut, you know. So people talk about braising, they talk about brisket and short ribs or
lamb shank,
some things like that. The thing that is unique about those cuts that makes them good for both braising and slow roasting is that they have a good amount of fat. They're of a good size.
Intramuscular fat.
And not only that, I wasn't going to drop the C word, collagen, so early in the cast, but that's another key thing. Collagen is the kind of connective, it's not exactly tissue, but it shares a property with fat, which is that when it is cooked properly into the right moment, it will melt and dissolve. So if you've ever had osso buco or short ribs,
that's
a sort of, you know, again, gelatinous can be a beautiful word if you're into it.
It's, and a it's a food podcast.
So it's all about melting the fat. Yeah. It's all about cooking the proteins gently until they kind of dissolve.
Can I say unctuous?
You can. I don't use that word, though.
Wait, you said, but you don't have to have tough cuts. So what are cuts that you would say are fatty cuts but not tough?
Fishes work in this scenario.
What types of fish?
Well, that's what I was going to say. So a fattier fish, like an oilier fish, which again doesn't have to be a bad thing. Salmon, sable. We did a really beautiful recipe with sable.
Also known, if you go to Nobu, as black cod.
Correct.
Which is that's
famous the world round for that miso black cod.
Yeah.
That's a very forgiving fish. Cod and halibut also are firm fleshed, but they're... It's really hard to overcook them.
It's interesting that black cod, like the, and also when you see it with salmon, it's the sort of the, there's like these like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like the sort of the, this is hard to describe. What are the sort of the planks of meat that are then separated by a little bit of fat and they kind of slide apart.
Totally.
Once you cook them slowly and softly with that black cod at Nobu or
yeah,
a
they're
slow
like
cooked
firm
salmon.
Fleshed and sort of like. They fall apart in chunks as opposed to flakes.
Exactly.
Like trout is like flaky.
Trout. Pshaw. trout.
And the good thing about, you know, including fish in your thinking about slow roasting and also chicken, which is another recipe that you and I have both made, you don't have to use 4 or 5 or 6 hours when you are doing fish. Like salmon, it's 35 or 40 minutes, but it's still a slow cooked method that then holds really well. So you would be surprised. They're great choices for dinner parties.
All right. So we've picked our cut, whether that could be a short rib or it could be a
you
big
could do
side
a
of
brisket.
Salmon or
you
brisket.
Do your pork shoulders.
Then next step, what about the cooking vessel?
I mean, a Dutch oven works great. You know, you want something that conducts heat well, but you could also use a cast iron pan, really.
If it's big enough.
If it's big enough. I mean, I would do a chicken in a cast iron pan.
Something with a heavy bottom, sturdy, conducts heat. Okay, so you got your big sturdy pot.
Yes.
You've got your cut of meat, whether it's a meat or fish. Next question, I have questions about this.
Yeah, this is great.
How low can you go when it comes to temperature?
That
how
is
low
a great,
should you go?
How much time do you have is really the question.
I don't know. If it's a Sunday, I might have all day.
I have done both pork shoulder and duck legs at 225 and gone to bed.
Really?
Yeah.
Uncovered or covered?
Uncovered.
Wow.
No, the duck was covered.
Okay.
The pork shoulder was not covered. But I would say safely, I wouldn't really go below 275 because it just takes forever for something to happen.
Yeah.
So I would say you stay in the 275 to 325 range.
Because you're talking about having that collagen breakdown, the connective tissue, the intramuscular fat.
There
you
needs to be
heat.
Some heat for this magic of alchemy and chemistry to happen.
Talk to me about sort of give me a therapy session on on pork shoulder, what I did wrong with something like you mentioned Bosom before we started the podcast, which is the... explain Bosom if
well,
anyone doesn't know it.
Bosom is like the now made famous by David Chang at Momofuku salt and sugar cured and then roasted pork shoulder until, and I think the original recipe says until it collapses.
Bone in.
Yeah.
And we are not braising that. We're just slow roasting
it. Yeah. That's 5 or 6 hours.
Covered or uncovered?
It's uncovered.
Really?
It's on a tray.
So I was just impatient back in 1997.
I think you probably, I don't know, what temperature? Do you remember where you were with temp?
I remember I was at some crappy apartment in Murray Hill.
Yeah.
I probably had the temperature too high, maybe not enough fat.
Yeah.
And I didn't,
because
wasn't, didn't
go
long
shoulder,
enough.
This is sort of a new thing to me. Can be delicious, not cooked to the falling apart stage.
No,
but
stop.
It's true.
No, stop.
We've run these recipes.
I know, but those recipes are dumb.
I think they're delicious.
Those ones where you slice it? I want to be able to reach my hand in there and just pull off a chunk.
That's fine. So you want to slow roast it.
Yes, I want to really slow roast it.
So a pork shoulder or short ribs, I've done both of these really successfully lately. You you have to give it time. So if you do, this is, I believe that the pork shoulder steaks are good. So that's like a quick cooking method before the proteins really seize up. The middle part is going to be tough and chewy and dry and not delicious. And then at the end, it will be transformed into something that totally falls apart, and you can take a pair of tongs and just get in there.
Oh, wait, you're talking the pork shoulder, cooking them like steaks.
Yeah.
Not just like a medium roast.
No.
Sort. Okay, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. All right,
yeah.
So the chain one, so you cure it with the salt and sugar. We also have one, a slow-roasted glazed pork shoulder from Mark Vetri.
Great recipe.
Which is kind of, is that kind of like an Italian version of the ish?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, it's got, this is, all right. So you wanted to say, like, where do we start and where do we end with this thing?
Thank you.
So I would take any cut of meat that you are going to do this preparation with. You want to season it really aggressively, as always, but big cuts of meat even more, right? So salt and pepper, and then start thinking about what spices you like. I like to add some spice so that when it's hanging out in the oven for so long, you do get some texture, and you have the advantage of being at a relatively low heat, so you don't have to worry about those spices burning. So things that I always go for.
Which happens if you pan roast something at high heat, those ground spices can turn acrid.
Especially
almost.
If you have a dry rub that has sugar in it, which the Bosom is like 50% salt and sugar, and you brush it off, but you don't even rinse it. So I like things a lot like fennel, cracked coriander seeds, cumin seed. Yesterday I did a pork shoulder. I put a lot of sumac on it, which has like a really...
And you will grind up these herbs, spices, either mortar and pestle or a spice grinder.
Yeah.
And rub
it
all
over
there.
Give them some wax.
Yeah.
Rub it all over.
Give it some wax? What?
You know, with a, you could just use whack.
Not like beeswax.
No, sir.
No, I don't know. You said wax.
Give it a few wax. And then a little olive oil, but other things like a little bit of miso paste, olive oil. If you have, you know, sriracha or gochujang or mustard or even condiments like that, just they add flavor and they get all yummy and crunchy and caramelized.
And I like the fact that they don't burn. Like sometimes when you do that with like rack of lamb, like a mustard coated rack of lamb, they want you to pan roast it first, and that stuff can get all weird and burnt and crusty.
Yeah.
Sorry. So this hangs out in the oven. How long typically, I imagine, do you want to let those spices and herbs and whatnot sort of hang out with the meat for a while before you put it in the oven?
Ideally,
yes. Yes.
But that's why sometimes I end up doing these braises at night the day before, because I'll buy them in the morning, season them, kind of let them sit all day, and then stick it in the oven at night.
We have, we have a great recipe. We have the slow roasted glazed pork shoulder by Mark Vetri online at bonapete.com. We also have a slow cooked short ribs with gremolata from Jelena restaurant in LA, by Travis Lett, the chef. I've never not braised short ribs. So this one, we're just seasoning the short ribs, putting them in on a roasting pan, and just sticking them in the oven.
This is an amazing recipe that really changed my whole thinking about short ribs. So this one you put on a rim baking sheet. And like I said, this one actually you cover with foil. So just because it's slow roasting doesn't mean you can't cover it.
But there's not liquid?
No, but it will create steam. The juices themselves will get in there and mingle. And it will be a moist environment, even though it's not.
don't say moist environment.
It will be, that's what. That cooking technique is a wet cooking technique, right? So just because just because you don't add liquid to come halfway up the side of the protein that you're cooking doesn't mean that it's going to be dry as bone in there.
No. Well, you know what I like about this whole thing, slow roasting thing you're talking about? when you're braising, it's like, oh, wait, I need to go buy wine. I didn't buy wine. I don't have wine for my braising.
Right.
But then I thought I had chicken stock in the freezer, but I don't. Now I got to go buy a box of that chicken stock, but I'm only going to use half of it. You're like, no, you don't need that stuff.
You don't need that stuff. In fact, a splash of water is really all you need. So the other thing, so we talked about browning. With a braise, you brown your meat first, right? You get a nice sear on that.
Yep.
You put it in, you deglaze, and you add the wine, and then you add your liquid, and then you put the meat back in, and then you put the lid on. Slow roasting is like the opposite. So you season it. And you put it in the oven, and it is very low heat. It's not taking on a lot of browning, but it's all happening inside. And in a few of these recipes, you want to brown at the end. So just because you slow roast it again doesn't mean that you're sacrificing a sear or crispy bits or any of that like lacquered finish. So the slow cook short ribs with gremolata from Travis, at the end when they're super, super tender, you just stick them under the broiler, which is an awesome thing to adapt in the summer. So slow roasting, again, I really like as a grilling technique. Ooh. Right? I'm not a big green egg person. I don't have a smoker, but I will start stuff in the oven, like our best ever ribs, BA's ribs. And then the actual grilling of the meat is just crisping it up and getting a good sear.
Yeah. And maybe throwing a little sauce on there, a little glaze at the end. Exactly. But you can do that with spare ribs. You can also do the short ribs.
So this slow roasted, the glazed pork shoulder from Mark Vetri, same thing. You cook it low and slow until it's like, you know that your internal temperature is good, it's falling apart, and then you just crank the oven at the last minute to get a little browning.
But he also does a little sort of glaze thing at the end to sort of like sort of shellac.
Exactly. And the balsam as well. I've never really had to do this, but there's a little sugar, like a sugar thing that you do at the very end and put it under the broiler to get like crackling.
Yeah,
basically.
We've talked about this. I'm a huge proponent of the broiler. Like I will broil
everything
at the end.
Well, that's what you do with rotisserie chicken. You've told me this.
Let's talk about this. So two of your recipes are on my Hall of Fame. Your rotisserie chicken, FAUX hyphen tisserie chicken on the bonappetit.com website.
Get it, guys?
And then also your duck leg one, the confit, quick confit or easy confit. The fotisserie, so what I love about this is like, I don't want to say I do want to say this actually. You know what? Screw it. I think a lot of people's roast chicken is overrated.
Okay.
It's like, they don't let it rest long enough. Like it's like the breast meat is piping hot. The meat on the legs is always not quite done enough, and it's a little pulley, and there's weird like strands, and like you're like, oh, this is kind of gross, and it's just like, but the rotisserie chicken, which you do, cooks for hours, and what it comes out it like is one of those rotisserie chickens you get at the corner store for $11, and yours is like just fall apart tender, and you're pulling off the bone, and it's incredibly seasoned. And it's basically nothing more than, like I said, you talked about some of those spices you like fennel and whatnot and some herbs. And you just rub it all over there, throw it in the oven and go to the park, come back 4 hours later.
Pretty much.
How many hours? Three-ish?
It's like three-ish. Three and the way
depends
that you test,
the
way
the
that you kind of know when it's ready, it does get really nice color on it. But the legs, no. Well, this is why you're a broiler proponent, but which I like. I think it's good. It's browning.
It
doesn't have, super crispy cut into it and it sounds like glass skin.
No, but it depends on a couple of things. Like, A, it depends on how your oven operates, where the rack is the lower or higher? But the point is, after 3 or so hours, the chicken's falling apart. You tug on the leg.
That's what I was going to say.
About to come off.
Right.
If it's not looking as burnished and sort of, amber or whatever, or as you like, throw it into the broiler for a little bit. Keep your eye on it. What I also like about this recipe is you're slow roasting the chicken on a bed of potatoes.
Correct.
That are sort of catching all the drippings, the seasoned spice drippings. That also, sometimes what I'll do, I'll give the little broil on the chicken, take it out, and then leave the potatoes under the broiler for another few minutes so they can get crisped up.
I think this is an excellent adaptation of this recipe.
One issue with the recipe, though.
Let's hear it.
Because like I said, I've made this several times, and I love it. And I love the potatoes, like I said, they sort of luxuriate in the juices of the chicken, and then you broil them. They get crispy. The chicken fall apart tender. And it's also one of the things you can like – let it go all afternoon. Then you can let it sit on a cutting board for 45 minutes. When you're ready to eat, you're ready to eat. It's spicy. There's a lot of spice in there. Mm-hmm. Maybe a tad more than I like.
Well, then you've adapted these other elements, and I feel that you should just take charge on that too.
Well, that's the thing with the recipe. If you're not a spicy person, don't put as much. Don't listen to us. Listen to yourself. You know?
I think also if you're a spicy person and you're reading the recipe and you're like, "Ooh, that sounds like a lot of spice," but I don't know. I don't like spice. I'll do it anyway. No, trust your gut.
Exactly.
Literally
your gut. Okay, so you got this beautiful fall apart tender meat, whether it's a short rib, whether it's a pork shoulder or chicken. Let's talk gremolata, because I love the notion of gremolata and like what that literally means and what that figuratively could mean.
Right. So literally, gremolata is a condiment that's traditionally served with osobuco, and it is a combination of raw garlic and citrus zest and chopped herbs, usually parsley.
Yeah.
And the purpose of it is
to all finely minced
together, like they were meant to be together from the beginning. And that is added at the very end. So you sprinkle that over, like maybe just over the marrow or onto the osobuco. And the point of it,
when it's out of the oven and ready to serve.
Si, senor. It's got to be done. Yes, this is a garnish. It's a condiment.
That was not Italian. That was Spanish. It sounded Spanish.
But that's okay. It's very similar. More about just communicating.
Signore?
Yeah. Anywho, so the purpose of that is to add brightness and a sharpness and even like a little bit of bitterness to counteract that sweet, sort of delicious falling apart. Tender,
cooked down, reduced.
You know, yeah. And also the flavor of that kind of protein is just like, it doesn't have a lot of brightness in the braise. Gremolata usually doesn't have a ton of texture, you know, because it's like herbs and the zest.
There's no crunch.
That's soft. So in the, I'm giving Travis a lot of love, in the slow roasted short ribs with gremolata that he did, I feel like there was
Travis Lett.
There's breadcrumbs and horseradish, which I really like.
Fresh horseradish.
Yes,
which you see a lot at restaurants, which I love when you go to, especially with short ribs, they'll grate, like with the microplane, grate some fresh horseradish over the short ribs. The fresh breadcrumbs I love because they have crunch.
Right. So that I thought was really nice, like sort of taking all those same ideas but adding a little crunch factor, which is really good. I like raw, crunchy, acidic things.
Which leads me to my next question. What are you serving with these unctuous meats?
I like fresh, crunchy
yes.
acidic things. So last night I made this pork shoulder, this slow roasted pork shoulder that I made it up. I would change a few things the next time I do it. But it was really successful. It only took maybe 2.5 or 3 hours. It was kind of a half pork shoulder.
Okay.
And served that with a salad of a green tart apple and fennel shaved. Gave this to husband, sous chef, best sous chef in Brooklyn, this guy.
Really? You trust him?
I do. Trust him with a mandolin.
Okay.
But it was pretty funny. I gave him the apple and the fennel and a lemon. And I was like, you could just make a quick shave salad with this. And he was like, okay. So he looks at it and he's like, gets out the mandolin. He knows that's needed. And then he turns and he's like, I'm just checking. So on the lemon, what am I doing with this?
You're not shaving
like,
that.
The lemon's for the dressing. He's like, got it. And it was delicious.
Did you throw any flat leaf parsley in
there? I didn't because Leo, my 13-year-old son, does not care for parsley. And I was trying to get the little guy to eat it, but I would have.
My 9-year-old son does not care for vegetables, period. So at least he. Yeah.
If I had grown-ups, you know, who like, if you don't eat it, if you don't like it, you eat it anyway, because to not do so would be rude. I would have put some almonds and I would have put some parsley or.
Quickly toasted almonds, perhaps.
Or even mint, you know, would
mint.
Be nice.
Oh, I love mint. Yeah.
And I would have put chili flake too, but that's fine. The apple
that
and fennel
perfect.
With the lemon and the olive oil and the salt was great. And it was really nice to have something cold and crunchy for the shreddy.
Yeah. I love that type of salad. Whether it's fennel, a lot of times I'll do the same thing with celery, celery and toasted almonds and parsley and whatnot.
Like cabbage. I saw
cabbage
some Savoy cabbage, some Napa cabbage. You can make just like a really quick slaw.
And you want, and I think for these types of salads, and I think most salads personally, but, when you're making a vinaigrette with say lemon juice and olive oil, I love to use rice wine vinegar. They always tell you like in cooking school, like the classic French ratio is 3 parts olive oil to 1 part acid, which I think is insane. I kind of do the opposite.
Yeah.
Like I want it really acidic.
Right.
Lots of vinegar and lemon juice and just a little bit of olive oil.
Yeah, I would say you might not even need the olive. If your plan is to serve these on the plate together and to encourage everything to be eaten in one bite, I think the fattiness and the richness of the meat with a forkful of salad, you might not even miss the olive oil.
All right. Did you serve a starch with this meal, or was this like healthy-ish
we
Sunday,
had some, Carla? Corn tortillas.
Interesting.
I had a lot going on yesterday.
Yeah.
I was also at the same time making meatballs and sauce. And
why?
It was one of those things where I did a big grocery shop. I hadn't like done that in a while.
Making me feel guilty because I did none of this yesterday
except
watch football.
You had football to watch.
Yeah.
And then I get home and immediately this like panic sets in, because when you're in the grocery store, if you're me, you're walking around going like, oh, I can make that with that and I'll make this with this and then we'll do that with that. And then you get home and it's like, oh, I actually like work every day and like starting tomorrow.
That's a problem, 'cause you're like, I'm not getting home till 7:30 every night and I'm not going to start braising something at 9.
Right. So I basically came home from the grocery store and got the meatballs going, the pork shoulder in the oven, and then I also made a really big batch of beef broth so that...
Jesus.
I know.
God, I feel bad. Were they good corn tortillas at least?
Yeah, they were. And I have leftovers. So that was the whole... The payoff is really like, there's leftover pork, there's meatballs in the freezer. It was just a whole...
What a great day. That's the best thing about cooking in the winter, whether you're slow roasting or braising, is that it sort, you sort of take your time. The house smells great. You got leftovers.
You feel like you did something, even though you basically were inside all day.
Yeah.
It gets just dark at 4:15.
Yeah, we're looking at the oven and smelling. Well, Cara, you made me really, really hungry. Thanks for coming on. Any parting thoughts?
You know, take it slow.
Yeah.
Just take it slow.
Take it slow. Cara Music, thanks much.
Thanks.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.